Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 25th of January. This hour, we take a look at Haiti, where, as one of our guests writes, life in the camps, where more than 1 million Haitians are still living, is no longer extraordinary. It's normal, since the rubble of their neighborhood remains more or less where it fell. They have no place to rebuild. They are stuck. The camps are like a prison. Haitians have had to individually carve out personal and familiar earthquake recovery plans with family and neighbors, removed rubble from their quarters, leaving it out on the streets in front of their homes for pickup. In Port-au-Prince and its environs, more than 1 million people living in sordid makeshift encampments, which are vulnerable to flood and epidemic. The character of the Haitian people could be the nation's greatest asset with competent and honest leadership, but there's a great dispute after the November election. And Haiti's former dictator, Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier, returned from exile. Why did he do that? We'll have two guests with us during the course of this hour, and we'll be welcoming phone calls. Professor Laurent Dubois is a professor of French Studies and History at Duke University and co-director of the Haiti Laboratory, Franklin Humanities Institute, author of the forthcoming book, Haiti, the Aftershocks of History. Later in the hour, Amy Wilentz, a journalist and author of The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier, will be joining us, currently at work on a new book about Haiti after the earthquake. A reminder that tonight is the State of the Union, and at 8 o'clock here on the Ideas Network, we bring you an NPR News special live coverage of President Obama's State of the Union address. Host Michelle Norris will be joined by NPR correspondents, and also you'll be hearing Congressman Paul Ryan's response to the president's address. So that's tonight at 8 o'clock. Welcoming phone calls this hour as we talk about Haiti, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And just to preview, tomorrow at this time, we will also be speaking with President George W. Bush's speechwriter, David Frum, who will be on from 9 to 9:30, and Don Gagne, NPR's chief political reporter, who will be in Wisconsin tomorrow, will be on from 9:30 to 10 for State of the Union analysis here on our program. Professor Laurent Dubois, thank you very much for joining us. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, you read about what's going on in Haiti, and let's start with those people who are still in camps, 1 million people. Why are they still living in those kinds of conditions?
Well, there's just this, been a very slow process of reconstruction, especially in Port-au-Prince. Actually, in some of the other cities, it's gone a little bit better, like in Léogâne. So there are people who have actually moved out of camps and into some kind of temporary housing. But there are just so many issues involved in the reconstruction, and so much of it has really stalled on the larger level, that's so many people are still stuck essentially where they settled right after the earthquake.
I have read, and I read it at the beginning of this show here, that people have to carve out their own space, and then they're removing the rubble themselves and putting it on the street for pickup.
Yeah, I mean, there's been an enormous amount of activity just on the individual level, and in camps have organized themselves, and there are small industries growing up in the camps, barbershops and other sorts of things. So there's a lot of self, organization that has long been the case in Haiti. But the bigger structural changes, the bigger efforts have really not progressed that much. I mean, there is, of course, just a massive amount of rubble and many, many difficulties, but there are also deeper issues about getting land and where neighborhoods should be reconstructed and all those kinds of things. And in many ways, the broader reconstruction effort has not progressed really as much as people had hoped at all on the larger structural level.
And is that due to lack of money or lack of leadership?
I think more lack of leadership, or rather it's not just simply lack of leadership, but it's the result of a whole configuration. A kind of situation, a bigger institutional situation that actually is very unwieldy and not very efficient, in which just so many actors are working together, but not always working together as well as they should. So there's that issue. A lot of money was promised, so there's money kind of available, but very little of it has been delivered, in part because of debates about what projects and how it should go. So it's a kind of larger paralysis that actually. I mean, it's not completely produced by the earthquake, because this is something that was the case in Haiti before, where just between the government and different NGOs and different foreign governments all involved, there's a lot of differences in of approach and conflicts that result.
Mm-hmm. So how much money is just being held and where is it being held? We've read that billions of dollars have been promised to reconstruct Haiti. Where is that money?
Well, a lot of that just was promised by different governments. So it's just remaining, undelivered as a kind of potential, somewhere in a budget line, I guess. But of course, at the same time, there was a shift in the sense that in the immediate post-earthquake process, there was a kind of emergency response, right, an emergency humanitarian response. And people donated money to that, and a lot of organizations like Doctors Without Borders or the Red Cross did, work for weeks or months afterwards. And then a slow transition to a kind of longer-term reconstruction effort, which most of those organizations are not participating in. So that's where the larger questions, of course, come into play. What are the new neighborhoods going to look like? How is this going to be structured? How is this going to be organized? What role for the Haitian state? What role for NGOs? What role for different kind of institutions? And so many, because so many of the institutions themselves were hard hit by the earthquake, there's a reconstruction of the very institutions going on as well.
I see. Amy Willens. Is joining us as well in a couple minutes, and she will give her perspectives on what's going on in Haiti. Can you tell me about the November elections? They were disputed elections. There are now a couple candidates who have officially been declared to be the two top runners, or what's the story?
Well, there was an election that was really marred by a lot of difficulties, enormous difficulties that just, I think were in some ways to be expected, which is just difficulties. A lot of people had lost IDs. There was a question about where people could vote. But there was a quite low turnout. There were a lot of complaints about the way that the election went forward, and just a lot of controversy and demonstrations around it. And the big issue, essentially, there's three main candidates who are in the running, and the big question actually is which of the Haitian election works in such a way that unless somebody gets more than 50%, there's a runoff election. So the big debate right now is which two are going to go into the runoff election. And while the Electoral Commission declared one person a winner, the OAS has now issued a report saying that a different candidate should be a winner. And everybody's kind of waiting to see what the official response will be from the Haitian government to see which two candidates will go forward in the next round of the election and when that election will be, which is still in the air a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And I believe Amy is joining us now. Amy?
Yes. Well,
yes.
The way Laurent is describing it, I like, because it makes it sound so sort of decorous and proper, but actually there's a huge amount of wheeling and dealing going on behind the scenes between the OAS and the Préval government. And I believe today there is a big rumor that the president's candidate, the one he's been pushing forward the whole time during this election, is going to concede and allow the elections to go forward as the OAS has conceived them, the runoff, that is to say.
And what's the wheeling and dealing?
Well, the wheeling and dealing is that, Préval wants to continue in power, and he's really put his foot down to have his candidate go forward into the presidentials, and the OAS doesn't want his power to continue. So the wheeling and dealing has been between the OAS and Préval, pushing Préval, putting a lot of pressure on him, even going so far as to threaten him with exile if he doesn't bow to the will of the international community.
Mm-hmm.
But in this election, what's really interesting to me about this election is how almost clearly the Haitian people have been eliminated from the discussion. Usually they're eliminated from the discussion, but there's at least a patina of their participation. But this time it seems like the vote count and everything else has been kind of lost in the shuffle of the wheeling and dealing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How would you assess Préval's leadership last year?
Well, it was really weak. It wasn't, I expected Churchill to emerge from the ashes of the earthquake, and instead we got silence. And I think it was a huge mistake on his part and a giant failure, and that he's paying the price for it now. But I think he wasn't sure what to do because he knew there was going to be this huge wash of international participation at that moment, and he didn't really know what to say. I mean, I don't forgive it because I think you have to say to the people of Haiti, come on, get out, go into the streets, move the rubble yourself. That's how we do things here, But he did not rise to the occasion. And then they swooped in, and I think he lost power, really.
Professor Dubois, do you agree?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that the whole question really, I mean, it exposed to some extent some broader weaknesses, which is just the way, I mean, as Amy was describing it, the way in which an electoral process or reconstruction is, you know, as much about all the international organizations and international pressures and different play as about the government itself. So, you know, Préval seemed, yeah, like unable to really kind of emerge as a voice that would direct things. And I think, again, there's this tremendous will on the part of people on the ground to rebuild and move forward. But obviously, without some larger direction, that's extremely difficult to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. So especially when they have all these little international organizations and large ones sort of seeming to provide a patchwork, but not really providing what Haitians need, which is rubble removal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the big. I mean, there's so many groups, and there's so much, you know, different. There's so many conflicts and reproduced effort between the groups. A great site went up recently, just showing a map of all the of many of the NGOs anyway working in Haiti, and it's just kind of bewildering to look at. And it's, you know, not really a very efficient way of moving forward. You know, you obviously need some kind of central leadership to really make things happen quickly, I think.
Give us an understanding of how much rubble is still there.
Well, it's interesting because really rubble has been removed. As I was saying, Haitians have really removed a lot of rubble. If you drive through Port-au-Prince right now, you see them doing it. I mean, they are actually with little buckets and teams taking the rubble of their houses out from behind neighborhoods and putting it in the street so that they can rebuild on the site of their old home in some fashion. But it's an extremely slow process if you do it that way. It's sort of like if the ants move the anthill as opposed to if you come along and sweep it away, if an organized effort were made with earth-moving trucks. But I believe it's some number of astrodomes. Laurent, do you know? It's just like a giant amount of rubble and cement that could fill like 3 or 4 astrodomes to the top or something like that.
Yeah,
I can't remember how many.
Right. I mean, it is just massive, and it's not, you know, not only the buildings that collapsed during the earthquake, but all the buildings that were harmed and kind of unsafe. And I mean, it's just a massive amount, kind of
right. There's rubble that's not even rubble yet, but you can't live in it.
Right. So there's all these standing buildings that, you know, are essentially unsafe to live in, and people are living around them. And so anyway.
So that's dangerous too.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. You should see the market downtown. People are under these things that are leaning in this way that you or I would never go under it to sell our wares, but they are sort of in this shrugging way under there because there's at least shade is provided.
Hmm. When you say you expected a Churchill to emerge, but Préval wasn't Churchill, is there a Churchill to emerge from this?
Well, no doubt among the incredibly voluble and articulate Haitian people, there could be a Churchill, but he's not among the political leadership right now, I would say. Do you see one, Laurent?
Not really, no. I mean, I think that's part of the, you know, and again, I think this is a larger, the disjuncture between a kind of, you know, real popular will and a lot of effort on the ground, and then the state structures and the political elite is so massive that, you know, even in the election campaign, which has, you know, some interesting people in it,
yes.
People like Maniga, who is really, you know, as a scholar, a legal scholar and so forth, but there's just such a disjuncture, and I think, as you said, it's been so obvious that, in a sense, the discussion is elsewhere, and the kind of democracy, the issue of democracy has been basically sidelined.
Right. Now, I wouldn't discount Martelly as a possible, you know, person around whom people could coalesce. He is articulate. He kind of could move people, I think. He can be emotional and appeal to people in a certain deep way. However, he's untried and he's very new to politics, and the simple weight of the way the Haitian political game is played could totally stifle him, in my opinion.
Well, tell me more about him and the other, the dancer.
The dancer?
Isn't there a dancer who's
that's,
one?
That's who she's meant. Martelly is
oh,
a
he is a dancer.
He's a singer.
He's a singer.
Yeah, Sweet Mickey. He's the leader of a band, a huge band that's a national phenomenon. And he, I mean, he's famously eccentric in his performance and has worn diapers on stage and women's clothes on stage. But you know, as he presents himself now, he's quite serious and very intense. I interviewed him the other day. He says all the right things about, you know, governance and moving forward, but I could say those things too, and nobody's putting me in the runoffs. I think he's to the right of center. But we don't really know. We don't know what his politics will be. Hmm. He's run a very sophisticated campaign. He's used outsiders, much to the irritation of Haitians. He's using a Spanish political consultant who's done some not my favorite campaigns in Latin America, like Calderon. He ran Calderon's campaign. So, you know, at least he's sophisticated, if that's what you want.
Hmm.
And he's articulate.
And he's very interesting.
He's certainly interesting. Yes, he captures one's attention.
I would imagine. And who else is there?
Well, there's Madame Maniga, who Mirland Maniga, who's an educator and a constitutional scholar. And I don't know that much about her, but she comes out of also a sort of right-of-center political background in Haiti.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, she's she's more, you know, inside the political system, or has been before, more than Martelly, who's presenting himself more as an outsider. I mean, she's older, and she's respected for her scholarly background. I mean, I know her work as a historian, a legal historian of Haiti. You know, so I think all the candidates, in some ways, this has been the case in other elections too, where you have, I mean, in some ways, it's not that there's a potential for an interesting debate, but the broader structural issues are such that, I mean, everyone kind of knows that that whatever president is elected will operate in a very constrained world, right? One in which the Reconstruction Commission and the broader government still hold the money, and therefore a lot of the cards. So it's, you know, there's a lot of energy to some extent around the election, but there's also this broader problem which limits what that president's going to be able to really do.
I think also that the people in power now are going to switch their focus if the government's candidate does concede today, which is looking likely. I think they'll switch their focus from the presidential seat as a focus of power to the legislature, which has traditionally just been a rubber stamp for the president when things are working well with the Haitian government, mm-hmm. so to speak. But I think they see that as a possible basis for their power, and the OAS report did not even look into whatever fraud may have existed for the legislative elections.
Absolutely, yeah, and that's pretty crucial, because obviously ever since the 1987 Constitution, the legislature has at least in principle, has a lot of power, and certainly during the last decade, they've could have wielded a lot of, could be a site for opposition. So it's interesting that hasn't even really entered the discussion so much, but it's a huge issue too.
Certainly grabbing attention here in this country, I don't know if it has as much in Haiti, is the return of the former dictator, Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier. Why did he come back, and is he a big distraction?
Go ahead.
The whole, his return has been just obviously occupying people in Haiti and outside, and it's just such a strange twist in a way, I think, because, it hadn't occurred to me as another thing that was going to happen.
That's right. It was a shock.
But it obviously raises all kinds of incredibly deep issues about, you know, how Duvalier is seen and what his, you know, the legacy of his regime. And I mean, there's so many things about that period in Haitian history that are fundamental for explaining the current situation. You know, not just in terms of, obviously there's the issue of his human rights abuses that has been brought up, and people bringing up charges, and the issue of where did the money go, and all these sorts of things. But then it's also that was the period that in some ways, you know, laid the groundwork for the kind of configuration that we have here in terms of, you know, forms of aid and I mean, different kinds of structures that are structuring Haitian reality. So, I mean, I think in the best case scenario, the most optimistic, it may be an opportunity to kind of really confront and deal with that period and you know, how it's set, what it's set up for the present. But it's also, of course, incredibly deep and painful and complex.
Why did he come
back? And he's a reminder to the Haitian people of a time when the president had full power.
Right.
And could run things.
Yes.
Think there's, although I don't believe in this nostalgia for Duvalierism, there is a nostalgia for someone who can lead the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so he comes back in, and they look at him, and they think, oh, right, yeah, someone once did lead the country, even if he was bad. Mm-hmm. And there's a hope for a strong president, I think.
Right.
What's he doing there?
Oh, I believe he's trying to sort of mess with the mind of the Swiss government and Swiss tribunals where his money lies. He has like $5.7 million left in a Swiss bank account, and it's been frozen for a long time. And the Swiss government just passed a law that will go into effect on February 1st, which is right around the corner, making it easier for governments like Haiti to lay their hands on these frozen accounts of corrupt officials and dictators.
Uh-huh.
So his hope, ostensibly his lawyers have agreed that this was the plan, was that he could go into Haiti, sort of hang out for a day or two, not that visibly, and then leave the country as a free man and prove to the Swiss that he is just a Haitian like other Haitians, right, without a price on his head or a legal battle, and that they would be forced then to relent and give him the money. But that has not happened.
Right. Yeah, there was obviously this confusion when he arrived, and then the next day, right, this question, well, is someone going to arrest him? Is there a warrant? All those sorts of things. Then he was eventually brought in for questioning. And so now, I mean, I think he was originally planning on having left by now, but now the kind of gamble has turned into something else.
I guess it's because he didn't have the $5.7 million already to spread around.
Right.
Right. Oh, my.
Yeah, so there's been strange spectacles all around. You know, there was a press conference with former Congressman Bob Barr, who joined him.
Right.
You know, and, I mean, it's been, you know, just a, I mean, I think there's been both humor and worry around it, and some uncertainty. But it is a measure of how confused the situation has gotten. And, you know, and I think, in a broader sense, what's interesting about the way that it came up, and especially people were noticing, young people sort of saying, well, he was a good leader, or this was a better time. And there is a certain amount of sense. I mean, partly it's simply, I mean, it's partly an artifact of U.S. policy, which was a policy that actually sent a huge amount of money into Haiti under Duvalier, under Jean-Claude Duvalier especially. And so people remember certain, you know, the roads and certain kinds of things that were different at the time. And it's going to be interesting how that plays out. And of course, that's seriously contested by other forms of memory of the Duvalier regime. And you know, there was never, I think, a full, you know, there are just these kind of different versions of that regime that are kind of competing right now for space.
Right, but when you see waiting around his hotel these guys in suits who are willing to say, yeah, we used to be Tonton Macoute, which was his secret police,
mm-hmm,
very scary, dangerous police that ruled with impunity all over the country, you kind of remember that perhaps that narrative will be the controlling narrative of the Duvalier era. But one other thing I wanted to say is, although it's true what Laurent is saying, that the U.S. did give a lot of support to Jean-Claude Duvalier during his era in power, Haiti was also not quite as penetrated by globalization, really not as penetrated as it is today. The economy wasn't as thoroughly undermined by globalization, the local economy. And I think that is one reason Haitians remember that time as being so much better. There was a local economy that worked instead of a local economy that's utterly destroyed.
Mm-hmm. But people died, right?
Oh, yeah. People died. People were imprisoned.
Yeah.
People were tortured by the police and killed and starved in the prisons.
Mm. And what is Bob Barr doing there?
That's up to Bob Barr to tell you. What do you think, Laurel?
Yeah, I actually have no idea. I mean, that was just, there's a couple.
It was like out of the blue.
From day to day, I just don't have any idea what these people are really thinking, you know. so I don't know.
And they're thinking a client is a client.
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, I think, you know, the worst thing of all, in a way, is, yeah, it's not the worst thing necessarily, but it's all about, I think, just money. And
right,
you know, it's probably going to boil down to some of the most simple issues of greed.
We welcome phone calls for both our guests. We're talking about all that's going on in Haiti, and there are many levels to discuss. The human level of people still living in rubble and taking care of the rubble themselves because the government isn't functioning very well to deal with the rubble, the disputed November election, and who remains in the race and what may happen today in terms of that race, the return of Haiti's former dictator, what he's doing there, the money that has been pledged from many governments all over the world after the horrendous earthquake last year, and how that money could be put to use if there were, as Amy has said, some Churchill to emerge to come up with a plan. All the international organizations that are functioning in Haiti, we'll talk about that more. Here's our phone number. Please join the conversation. I know there is great interest in Haiti among many of you in Wisconsin. Many of you have been there as we did programs on the earthquake a year ago. Many of you were talking about your experiences in Haiti. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you would like to use that, is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program, we'll speak with one of the authors of Not Quite Adults, Why 20-somethings Are Choosing a Slower Path to Adulthood and Why It's Good for Everyone. Tonight, we will be presenting, giving you coverage of the President's State of the Union address. That's at 8 o'clock tonight here on the Ideas Network. Michelle Norris will be joined by NPR correspondents for analysis. Plus, you'll also hear the Republican response from Congressman Paul Ryan to the president's address. It's an NPR news special tonight. It's at 8 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And our guests, as we talk about Haiti this hour, are Amy Wilentz, journalist and author of The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier. She's currently at work on a new book about Haiti after the earthquake. And Laurent Dubois, professor of French Studies and History at Duke University, co-director of the Haiti Laboratory, Franklin Humanities Institute, and author of the forthcoming book, Haiti, The Aftershocks of History. We go to Linda from La Crosse, our first caller. Hi, Linda.
Hi, good morning to you and your guests. I'm calling because I've just been reading about Aristide, and I wonder if both guests feel that it is commonly acknowledged now that the United States got rid of Aristide twice, and he was a Churchill. I've heard him speak, and he disbanded the army, which had only been used against the Haitian people, and he tried to institute mass education and health care. Now, when you say these two people who are contenders for the presidency now are both center-right or right, what sort of programs do they have? I guess those are my two questions. Is one, why can't Aristide come back? He was the only democratically elected president ever of Haiti. And two, what do these center-right people want for Haiti?
All right. Thank you, Linda.
I'm ready.
Go ahead, Amy. Take it.
I think Linda is correct that no matter whose hand plucked Aristide out of power two times, the United States was involved. The first time was under Bush the father, and the second time was under what I like to call Baby Bush. So both times Aristide was taken out of power, and it was at least with the go-ahead, I believe, from the United States. And he was, it was desired that he remain in exile by the U.S., and if you read certain recent WikiLeaks papers, you can see that that was the case. They were already, like 5 months after he was put into exile, they were trying to make sure that he could not return. As for him being the only freely and fairly elected president of Haiti ever, that's not true. The sitting president is a freely and fairly elected president of Haiti. That's partly Aristide's fault, because Aristide allowed it to seem that Préval would bring Aristide back. And Préval made, for him, a wise decision not to bring Aristide back, because he probably wouldn't be the sitting president anymore. I think that Aristide's instincts were exactly as this caller says. He wanted health care for the people. He wanted education for the people. But on the ground, his ability to get those things done was very limited. He didn't have that much time and power the first time. And the second time he was, I think his mindset had changed. He didn't want to lose power, and his methods had changed. And he was no longer able to do what he wanted to do. Of course, he was under huge amount of pressure the entire second term and was finally asked it again.
Laurent, you want to add?
Obviously that's the other big, immediately when Jean-Claude Duvet returned, people thought, well, why can't Aristide come back, right? It sort of seems like a strange contrast. And there's always talk about Aristide's possible return, which, People have obviously different opinions about some eagerly wish for and others don't. But I think, yeah, the role of the United States, I would agree with Amy. And a bigger point, which is just a historical point, because it's just so often repeated, is the idea that this was sort of the first election. And that's also a little off base in the sense that there was, you know, a 1930 election that elected a President Samuel Vincent, other elections. I mean, many of them troubled elections, I would say, but it gives an idea that there was sort of never any form of elections or democracy in Haiti before 1990, which also isn't true. But I think the real question is, you know, what's Aristide's legacy, I think, is the big issue and the kind of live wire in Haitian politics. And, you know, what's left of that project and what could be a new project that would really begin to address the serious, deep social issues that he tried to address. I mean, obviously, those are still there and still present and even more urgent than ever. So, I mean, and then, of course, going back to Aristide's regime just raises the same eternal questions about the way in which foreign forces and foreign powers have shaped, often for the bad, Haiti's situation. So, I mean, I think I'm not sure what will transpire with him in particular, but there's no doubt that as with Duvalier, there has to be a kind of real debate about what happened and what might happen differently to push forward projects like that in the future.
I can't help but feel, Laurent, and tell me if you agree, that with Aristide, Haiti was raising its head again in some way that provoked a psychological response almost from the United States that had to do with the Haitian Revolution and the way America felt about the Haitian Revolution, you know, 200 years ago, which was this was too much empowerment. They sort of felt that way about Duvalier the father.
Mm-hmm.
But with
yeah.
Aristide, especially in ways that they didn't feel with the Cuban Revolution, which was more purely political, there was some sort of visceral reaction mm-hmm. to this guy.
I think maybe. I mean, I think it's a great way to think about it because there's 30 years of the Duvalier dictatorship. The beginning of that, the U.S. really, there was a brief moment under Kennedy where there was a kind of attempt to push out Duvalier or at least resist Duvalier, and then that settled into kind of an acceptance that this was essentially like the only thing that Haiti could have. I mean, I think, and that's part of the legacy of the Duvalier regime is also a kind of broader culture of a kind of idea that that's just what the country had to be, and that's, you know, they needed a strong leader. And Duvalier, of course, played on that and urged people to believe that as well. So the idea of Haitian democracy as a real possibility, right, as a real, something that would embody the future, I think was on purpose kind of delegitimized by Duvalier and also in many ways by various U.S. observers. So there is that kind of, and I do think that's connected to deeper issues, which is Haiti as a kind of perpetual challenge going back, way back. And if you think about what happened in the 80s with the AIDS, you know, accusations of AIDS and all kinds of other, the vision of Haiti itself,
right,
that was kind of promulgated in that period, you, I think, in the face of something kind of much deeper almost, this maybe a certain kind of political
version.
Unconscious. So.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email from Bonnie. Can you both please describe this small Haitian upper class? Were they the ones principally opposed to Aristide? And how common are sweatshops in Haiti? How many are U.S. owned?
I can't answer that last thing. How many are U.S. owned? I know some people who run factories down there, but I wouldn't call them sweatshops, and they are American, but I don't know if they're still American citizens. But I assume there are some that are American owned. And the first part of the question was?
Can you talk about the small Haitian upper class?
Oh, yeah,
and the
morally repugnant elite. I think that the small Haitian upper class was constitutionally opposed to Aristide, who seemed to want to get rid of their power. So understandably, they opposed him. But I'm not convinced that they, without what I consider to be the import-export business class, which is not quite the elite, but does exist and is small, without the machinations of that class, I'm not sure that Aristide would have been as easily destroyed by the white-skinned, light-skinned upper class.
Hmm. We haven't talked about the cholera epidemic that raged across the country recently, 4,000 people killed. Are you both concerned with the next rainy season that could reemerge?
Well, it's obviously, I mean, we've done a couple of work here with the Global Health Institute at Duke about talking about the cholera epidemic. It's obviously a huge concern. I mean, and I think people are watching it very closely, trying to figure out whether it's going to continue to spread or alternatively start to subside? I mean, and it's difficult to know. Obviously, the conditions are extremely dangerous, and the number of deaths are, you know, extremely unfortunate. But you know, it's a strange history in a way, in the sense that cholera, this is, as far as we can tell, maybe the first cholera epidemic in Haiti. I mean, in the 19th century, when there were other epidemics in other parts of the Caribbean, they didn't get to Haiti, as far as we can tell. You know, and then the political fallout about the question of where it came from has also been important, although overshadowed now by other events.
It's strangely like the AIDS epidemic, which also came from the outside,
mm-hmm. right?
Ostensibly,
right.
And was brought into Haiti by the tourist trade, and then Haiti became the focus of international loathing because of how quickly the epidemic spread through the population.
Mm-hmm.
And that's apparently also true of the cholera epidemic, which supposedly came from some soldiers from Nepal who are in the UN forces. So, you know, it has this weird provenance and this deep mythology also. And one other thing is that cholera strangely plays into Haitian traditional practices, the washing of the dead, the feeding of mourners after the washing of the dead. Usually the same women who wash the bodies of the dead also prepare the food for the mourners.
Oh.
Sometimes the cholera has killed an entire family
because
of funeral practices.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's really sad.
Oh. How much can one country take?
Oh, well, the Haitian people are resilient.
I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it is a kind of, you know, and when you gather, obviously, with Haitian writers and artists and talk about this, I mean, there's this kind of unbelievable, you know, from the very beginning, which is the roots in exile and the Middle Passage and this brutal slave system through, you know, a difficult revolution and so on. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, one thing too, I think we always have to point this out is that it's not all that, right? You know, that there's the sort of a Haitian population there's been times that have been relatively good and prosperous in Haitian history. There's different communities with different kinds of realities. And, you know, it's hard not to focus on all the problems, which are, of course, overwhelming. But there's obviously a lot more. And when you go to Haiti, obviously, you see, you know, a much more complicated reality. But it's certainly a culture that's had to confront just wave after wave of difficulties.
Right, but its international image is, again, I hate to say, is colored by the history that the first world is very uncomfortable with. So
right,
that
right.
You get, I know when I talk about Haiti, if I just raise the issue, they say, "Oh, those poor people! It's such a terrible place. I
right.
would never go there." Da, da. But actually, when you're there, it's fabulous and full of life, even now,
mm-hmm.
and
right.
exciting. And you know, Haitians are still having fun and going to cockfights on the weekends and having weddings that are beautiful. I mean, it's an incredible culture, and I hate that it is. You know, because it has these terrible tragedies, especially recently, that it seems to be this locus of just pure misery.
Right. You, I believe it was you, Amy, who said the character of the Haitian people could be the nation's greatest asset with competent and honest leadership. Can you talk more about that character? You intimated what it is just now, but tell me more.
Well, I mean, you can't characterize a whole people, and certainly I'll just talk about the good points of good Haitian character, okay? And you can assume that there are bad points of bad Haitian character. But, you know, there's a deep charm. There's a French aspect of the Haitian personality. There's the incredible community of the African side of their culture. And they're really funny. And maybe that's because the history has been so tough. But they really, humor is a major part, and there's always a joke going around. The other day in Haiti, I saw, I don't even know what the joke was about, but as I walked down a street, there was a service going on for the dead of the earthquake, an anniversary service at the ruins of the cathedral. And somehow down the street, I was walking down, I could tell, I couldn't quite sense what it was, but there was a joke being passed from Haitian to Haitian, not even people who knew each other.
Oh.
About something that was happening there. I couldn't quite get it because my Creole isn't quite good enough. But that's what it's like.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I think the humor has been crucial afterwards. And, you know, I mean, not that long after the earthquake, there was, you know, a sort of set of ways of thinking about it that passed through humor as well as spirituality and other things.
Hmm.
And I think that, the other thing to recall, I think it's just worth repeating over and over again, is that this is a culture that emerged from a slave revolution, and what, you know, this kind of constant aspiration to create something that was an alternative to this plantation reality, to being forced, you know, into certain kind of situation by outsiders, and this real desire to cultivate autonomy and dignity, and in many ways that's this great achievement of Haitian culture, which was to refuse a certain kind of future that was supposed to be theirs, and instead to create a different kind of future, and I do think that's part of the reason for the resistance. I mean, my Haitian sociologist Jean Casimir always says Haïti dérange, you know, Haiti disturbs, and there's a way in which it's disturbed partly because it has, you know, created this other sort of reality, and I think people who, you know, are familiar with Haiti experience that and see a whole other side to it.
Mm-hmm. And that's why Préval, that's one of the many reasons why Préval was so resistant to the OAS report, saying that his candidate couldn't win, even if his candidate hadn't really won.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he just wanted to dig in his heels and say no to the international community.
Right. I can see why this country absorbs both of you the way that it has. I understand.
I'm beginning
it.
To feel it's an illness when I'm on the show. But you know.
Oh, it's not. You're both fascinating. Let's go to Ann from Madison. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Well, I think everybody knows that if the United States and probably France, maybe Canada as well, hadn't approved Duvalier's return to Haiti, one of the most detested people who ever led Haiti, maybe other than his father, he wouldn't have been able to return. And I can't imagine anything more destabilizing to people who are old enough to remember him than to have him, who practiced the most hideous tortures. I mean, he stole millions of dollars from the Haitians. He parked it in Swiss bank accounts. And my understanding is, from other analysts, that he was told that if he wanted access to what remains of these accounts, he had to return to Haiti and then leave voluntarily, not be forced to leave. So I really think that, to describe what's going on in Haiti as anything other than a United States and maybe France further attempt to control the most exploited Western country in the whole world is absolutely, that would just be unrealistic. I just think we owe Haiti, if they want Aristide to return, and we're not letting him return, we're making sure he's parked in South Africa without the ability to return at this point, but we're letting a Duvalier return to Haiti. We want to continue to exploit Haiti to the hilt, and that's why Haiti has had so many problems.
Thanks, Anne, for your call. Laurent, you want to start?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it goes back a long way. There's no doubt that there's been this perpetual, a series of actions on the part of foreign countries that have led to this. I think the thing is that it's always been an interaction too with Haitians themselves, and part of the real difficulty now is figuring out. I mean, I always have these debates with Haitian intellectuals that I work with, you know, where I emphasize the sort of U.S. force, and they will respond by saying, well, yes, of course, but the real question is, why have we allowed this to happen to us? You know, why have we not been able to alter our own situation, you know, despite all our resources and capacities? So, you know, the problem is to figure out how to get out of that. And I think at this point there is there's been a long enough cycle of political habits and that are a way of responding to foreign control, that you are, you know, into the sort of third turn. Well, I don't even know if it's the third turn or down the road with just Haitian political habits and the way that they intersect with these foreign habits. And it's a really tough knot to untangle.
Can you talk more about Anne's point? What say so does the United States have as to whether or not Duvalier returns to Haiti? The plane lands there. Who has?
I don't think the United States had a big role in this, but I will say this: France probably knew toward the very end, at least, of his trip that he was going back because he came in from Paris to Guadeloupe and then left Guadeloupe and went to Haiti. And
yeah.
I think France had to have had,
by the
end, some idea that he was coming in. But someone, and this to me is key, someone in Haiti had to approve his getting from the plane into the country.
Right.
And that's where the U.S., France, Canada, the Haitian government, the guy at immigration had to play a role.
Yeah. Right.
And I'm not sure what happened there, but it was, I'm sure, very complicated negotiation, and I'm sure almost 100% that money changed hands. But I don't know into whose hands that money would have gone that would have been powerful enough for him to ride freely from the airport to his hotel.
My. Art from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Two things. One is someone recently gave me a historical novel on the Haitian Revolution, All Souls Rising by Madison Smart Bell, which I've just started reading. So if you have any take or recommendation on that, I'd be interested. The other topic, it relates to Cuba's role in Haiti. One of the other public radio stations had someone on from the BBC recently as to why the U.S. had supported Duvalier's. They said, well, the U.S. was afraid there would be like a Cuban kind of revolution or takeover in Haiti. But what I'm aware of is a very heavy, central, but not very publicized role of Cuban doctors in dealing with the cholera epidemic and the earthquake situation, and even before the earthquake situation. So I'd be interested in any comments you have on either.
Thank you, Art.
Well, ever since Aristide took power, he and Preval both have relied on Cuban medical aid, and they brought in Cuban doctors to help out, and I'm sure that they're around the country helping out with the cholera epidemic. It's been really important and really useful, and they work with Americans. I mean, I've seen them at Partners in Health. I've seen Cuban doctors and Cuban medical students helping out and working hand-in-hand, you know, with people from all over Latin America and the U.S. So I think that was a really great thing, but I do agree that it certainly made the Americans nervous. Any time you say the word Cuba, the American government gets nervous, although I think that's maybe getting a little better with Obama. I hope so. So that's been important. I think one of the things that's been hard for the U.S. with Preval is that Preval really couldn't give a hoot about the U.S. Apparently, at some point during one of his administrations, they said, well, if you don't do this, we're going to revoke your U.S. visa. And he said, I don't care.
Oh my.
You know, I'm not going there. He is much more turned to Latin America. He speaks Spanish. His English is okay, but he speaks Spanish. And he's worked with Chavez,
right?
As did Aristide. He works with some of the people that the U.S. government has considered not good allies for anyone to have. You know, they don't want to permit the extension of these people's power. But these people have been very good friends to the Haitian government, so... You know, that's another reason for the U.S. to be wary of the Latin American allies of Haiti.
We'll ask Ron to talk about Cuba in a moment, too. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about Haiti this hour of the program. Professor Dubois, would you like to comment on Cuba?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I just agree. I mean, I think Cuban doctors have been played a very crucial role, and again, there's been support. And it goes, you know, again, that connection... Has been valuable. The earlier question about the history, it's certainly the case. I mean, quite obviously the case that Duvalier was able to play off U.S. fears about the Cuban Revolution in order to kind of gain, you know, get more, not at first just sort of grudging, not support, but just sort of stay in power and eventually support as well in the longer term. So that's absolutely the case. I wanted to mention the in terms of the novel. I mean, Madison's trilogy. It's a trilogy that goes all the way to independence, and it's a great. I mean, I would urge you to read all three. It's about 2,000 pages. He also wrote a biography of Toussaint Louverture. But another really remarkable novel that I would urge people to read if they're interested in understanding the Duvalier period is this Marie Chauvet novel, which was just recently translated, called Love, Anger, Madness. Just translated in 2009, and it's a really fascinating book and a really fascinating story about a Haitian writer who has not been as well known in the U.S. And I would just, it's a great way to kind of get into understanding a bit about that period as well.
Love, Anger, Madness.
Love, Anger, Madness, the trilogy. And she actually died in the United States. She fled into exile, and the book was really even not distributed when it was written because of fears of reprisals. But it's a really remarkable book that people have access to now.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything, Amy, the world community can, should be doing, the government or the nonprofit organizations, the health organizations that are in Haiti right now, to move people into some kind of structures so there are not so many homeless people?
Well, you know, Haitians don't like to be homeless, so they're not quite exactly homeless, as far as I can see. They are living in temporary, mostly self-built housing in these internally displaced camps, displaced people's camps, IDPs, they're called by the international community. And when you go in, when you're outside these camps, which are mostly built on public spaces, the few public spaces that there are in these towns and in the capital, you think that, oh, my God, this is a terrible, ramshackle place of tents and tarps. But when you go in, you feel like you're in what is not that savory, but is a normal Haitian shantytown. I mean, it's amazing how the Haitians have duplicated with what little building materials they had the shantytowns they used to live in. The difference is that many of the people now living in these shantytowns were not living in shantytowns before. So they're living in these, you know, very bad conditions from having been very lower middle class people, people who ran beauty parlors and dry cleaning shops that collapsed. They're now living in a virtual tent city. So it's very weird, and it's a very mixed community, and it's very hard to rebuild because the rubble is still there, and people don't want to go out to the dry, arid suburbs where there's no business and no commerce to try and live in, you know, semi-permanent housing built by the international community. Mm. It's just not very appealing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you both so much. It was an extraordinarily interesting article. I appreciate all of your knowledge. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Our guest, Amy Wilentz, journalist, author of The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier, and she's working on a book about Haiti since the earthquake. Laurent Dubois, professor of French Studies and History at Duke University, co-director of the Haiti Laboratory, author of the forthcoming book, Haiti, The Aftershocks of History. That was fascinating, wasn't it? Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. News coming up, and we'll return.